Can I have everybody's attention? Just for a second. I know everybody wants to wander around and look at these wonderful displays, and I'm sure that you'll get a chance to do that. I'm using the cane. I don't know if that matters. Working on the program committee of the church board. And I just want to tell y'all a little bit about this wonderful find that we have found to share with you all. Award-winning photographer John Nelter drove 40,000 miles across the United States asking people from diverse backgrounds one simple question. What does peace mean to you? In a world that asks us to focus on the things that can separate us, his resulting multimedia arts project called A Piece of My Mind encourages us to rediscover the common humanity that connects us. John has been telling stories with words and images for 25 years for national magazines, Fortune 500 countries and companies, and nonprofits. His work has appeared in National Geographic, Traveler, Forbes magazine, Midwest Living, and the New York Daily News, among many others. Throughout his career, he has managed logistics for editorial and commercial clients, both nationally and internationally, working on three continents. John carefully arranges details and builds relationships with his clients using humor, understanding, and compassion to craft compelling and insightful stories. He is sought after as a presenter and a lecturer. He has spoken at the Nobel Peace Prize Conference, the National Civil Rights Museum, the Gandhi King Conference on Nonviolence, the Sojourner Summit for Change, and at colleges and universities all across the United States. He shares his belief that art and storytelling have the power to transform our hearts as well as our community. So I'd like you all to join me in welcoming John to Epworth.
Thanks, Missy. Can you hear me okay? This is a nice little lullaby going on over here with the waves, isn't it? What a beautiful day and what an amazing place you have here at Epworth. Thank you for letting Karen and I be a part of it for a few days here. In just, the 24 hours or the 28 hours that we've been here, I've begun to get a sense of the depth of the roots that are in this place. So I met somebody yesterday that told me that they'd been coming here for 34 years. And I met somebody else who told me they'd been coming here for 76 years. And I met someone today that said they had been coming here for 13 years, but she was only 12 years old. So I'm trying to do the math on that. My connection to Epworth is pretty new. But I have been to Ludington before. My first job out of college was across the lake in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, at the Herald Times Reporter, the newspaper, and it was in 1990 and 91, which is when they were reestablishing the ferry service that came here. And so there was one day we got into a single prop plane and we puttered across the lake and we landed here to photograph them working on the ferry. And then somebody showed me around town, and it was that day that I realized that you all got the good side of the lake. Like this is the better part of the lake. So it's nice to be back here. I'm excited to talk with you about this project called A Piece of My Mind, which really began as a small personal project, and it's become my life's work. It was not that long ago, I guess it was this spring, I was in Memphis. And of course, this is the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, and I was reminded to turn on my thing. I was reminded of Dr. King's notion of beloved community, which is this idea that we could mature into a world that sees beyond prejudice and discrimination, that our circles of compassion could expand to embrace all people. And I think you don't have to look very far to recognize that we've fallen short of that ideal. You open up the newspaper, you turn on the television, and you realize in all sorts of ways we've failed to live up to that high aspiration of beloved community. But for me, when things feel hopeless, when it seems like the challenges of the world are bigger than the solutions we bring to the table. I think it's also really important that we take time to acknowledge what's good in the world. We're surrounded by goodness in the world, and sometimes that's really hard to see and hear given the noise of the world that's around us. I've made my living as a freelance photographer for the last 25 years, and I shoot for national magazines and Fortune 500 companies, and I've had the good fortune of shooting travel assignments around the United States and across the country, and I've come to realize over the years that it's my job to find beauty in unexpected places. That people hire me to find good where other people might struggle to see it. And that doesn't mean that we ignore the challenges that we face. The world is filled with challenges, and it's important that we face those directly and head on. But I also believe that it's imperative that we face those challenges with a grace, a hope, and the belief that something better is possible. So as a freelance photographer, you're constantly making choices about the jobs that you'll accept. Does this square up with my worldview? Does it support ideas that I believe in? Does it pay enough to justify being away from my family for a certain length of time? And at our house, we've embraced the saying that some jobs feed the belly. And if you know how this ends, go ahead and say it with me. Some jobs feed the soul. And when you're really lucky, your job can do both. Well, back around 2009, I found that there were two things going on in my life. And the first is that my soul was getting hungry. I was frustrated with the quality of our national dialogue in 2009. I was concerned about all the things that ask us to look at what separates us, whether it's politics, ethnicity, religion, gender, class, you name it. If you choose to go through life dividing, you've got all sorts of tools at your disposal. But I wondered if there was a way I could use my photography and storytelling instead to look at what connects us, to look at what we share in common. So that was the first thing. My soul was getting hungry. The second thing that happened in 2009 is, I like to say, the economy handed me some free time, if you know what I mean. The recession hit the world of freelance photography really hard, and my workflow dropped quickly and dramatically. And if I was a better business person, I probably would have used that time to look for new clients. But not every decision is based in dollars and cents. Right? There are different ways that we can measure success. And like I said, my soul was getting hungry, and this is how I chose to feed it. So I started talking with people about this idea of peace. Now, in all my travels, I haven't met many people who wouldn't welcome a little bit more peace into their lives, whether it's their immediate family or their neighborhood or the larger world. Even my friends who serve in the U.S. military, I think, would prefer to stay home with their families whenever possible. But here's the interesting thing about peace. We say that we want it, but we're not very good at getting it. We're not very good at making it. So you'll have high school students that might flash the peace sign while they walk down the hall and frame up their selfies, but then they'll form into cliques and they'll bully their own classmates. You'll have peace activists on the street with a sign that says, give peace a chance, but they can't get along with their immediate family members. You'll have two countries that claim they want to find a peaceful resolution to a conflict, but they can't agree on the shape of the negotiating table to sit at. And in my own church in Minnesota, called ironically Peace Lutheran Church, you'll have people that nod up and down on Sunday morning while they listen to the story of the Good Samaritan, story about helping someone in need, no matter who it is, and Monday they'll walk right by someone in need like it's not their problem. So there's a disconnect, right? That's not a critique of my church, that's a critique of the human condition, because it happens all the time. There's a disconnect between what we say we value and how we live our day-to-day lives. And that's what I wanted to explore. So I started asking this question, what does peace mean to you? And on the surface, that's a really simple question. But it very quickly gets at the core of who we are as human beings and what we value as a society. It opens the door to conversations about race and gender, about national policy and international priorities. It really gives people an opportunity to talk about what's close to their heart, what their mission and vision and values that are important to them. And once I established the question, the process was ridiculously simple. I sat down, and I talked with them, and I just listened. That's it. It's a skill that we learn at a really young age, and we spend the rest of our lives forgetting how to do. We'll listen to correct or convince or coerce somebody. We'll listen to debate or debunk, but the simple act of listening just to understand is rare. And imagine if we could take more time doing that. So when I started listening, I started hearing these little bits of wisdom from people that I think get lost in the noise of day-to-day life. I heard from people like Jarrell Wilson, who started his interview by saying, "I'm black, gay, Christian, and I live in Texas." He said, "By all means, you would think I might be miserable, but in fact, I see beauty everywhere." And I met Panina Bowman in Atlanta, who talked about being growing up as a young girl in Second World War Europe. And she said one day soldiers knocked on the door and said, "Pack your things, you've got 20 minutes and then you're going to leave." And they didn't know where they were going to go, but they wound up at Auschwitz. And Panina's parents and 42 other members of her family died at Auschwitz. And she talked about how difficult this entire journey was, but she said she made a conscious choice not to hate. She said, because hate is a powerful emotion and it's intended to destroy somebody else, but in fact, it comes around and it destroys you. And I met Deanna Thompson. Deanna, when she was 42, was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. It metastasized into her bones. She was diagnosed and was given 5 years to live. Nobody with that diagnosis tends to live longer. But I interviewed Deanna 6 years past her diagnosis. At our book release party, she came to help celebrate, and she was 8 years past her diagnosis. And when we had lunch a couple of months ago, she was 10 years past her diagnosis. So I asked Deanna, I said, "What's it like to go on living when you know that you're dying?" And she said, "Well, that's something that we're all doing. Just that some of us are doing it a little bit more acutely than others." Deanna said, "Initially I thought I was on sabbatical to get ready to die. Then it became clear that I wasn't dying right away." And she said, "We don't know what to do when we ask somebody how they're doing and they don't reply by saying, 'Fine, thanks, how are you?' We shy away from those conversations because we don't know what to say. We're afraid of saying the wrong thing, and sometimes we're really hard on each other for getting it wrong. It's not that people don't say stupid things, they do. But I'm hoping we can have a little bit more grace in dealing with one another when that happens." So I got to go places that I didn't know existed for this project. I got to go to Nicodemus, Kansas to meet Angela Bates, and Nicodemus was settled by freed slaves after the Civil War. There used to be a lot of towns like this west of the Mississippi. As far as I know, Nicodemus is the only one that still exists. And Angela says that she feels like she's a descendant of people with great vision and courage and faith in God. And she was really proud of that heritage, and everybody in the town was. They wanted to do something to honor that. So they approached the National Park Service, and after 20 years, the National Park Service said, "Yeah, you know, you're right, we should honor this." And so they built this interpretive center, this great museum, to honor the heritage of a town settled by all freed slaves. And here's where we get tone deaf as a society. They staffed it with all white people. It doesn't make any sense, right? But it happens all the time. And the people of Nicodemus wanted to tell their own story. And so Angela is the head of the Nicodemus Historical Society, where they run their own museum so that they can tell their own story. I should add, the National Park Service is getting better. They're getting more diverse in the way that they present things. But Angela talked about how frustrating this was as they went through the process, as they saw those results. And she also talked about some of the challenges of being an African-American woman in the country today. But she said, "Still, I have a choice. How am I going to respond to the world around me?" And I think we all have that choice as we go through our day-to-day lives. We might not be able to control all of the things that happen to us, but we absolutely can control the way we respond to it. So sometimes I feel like a piece of my mind gets a little bit earnest, and so I try to interject a little bit of whimsy into it. And when I got done interviewing Angela, I said, "Hey, what do you think the odds are that we can get the whole town together for a portrait?" And she said, well, you'll probably get everybody except for my dad because he's kind of crabby. But in fact, he showed up too. There he is right up there. So that is the whole town of Nicodemus, Kansas. 16 souls farming wheat and milo out on the Kansas prairie. Well, 16 people and one chihuahua, I guess. That's Nicodemus, Kansas. So I got to go places that I didn't know existed. I got to go places that I had always dreamed of going. Have you all seen the movie Forrest Gump? Yeah, okay. You saw the shrimp boats in the movie with those wings that hold the nets out to the side? I'm a photographer. I'm a visually driven person. So I wanted an excuse to be able to photograph shrimp boats. So I made a couple of phone calls, and I was able to connect with Kenny Terrio. And Kenny is a third generation Cajun shrimper in Chauvin, Louisiana. And I sat down with Kenny at his home, and I asked him, I said, what's it like to be a shrimper? And he said, well, you go out there and you find shrimp and then you catch them. Now you know how to be a shrimper, in case you wanted to know. But he went on and he talked about the culture of those shrimping communities. And he said, when we were shrimping, we all worked together. And one would build a boat and we'd help him. And the next would build a boat and we'd help him. And then pretty much everybody wound up with a boat. So that worked out pretty good. He talked about this sense of community, this sense of making sure that everybody is able to thrive together and everybody working together to lift them up. He also talked about how things have changed from the time he was a young boy. He said, I don't think people got time to socialize these days. They leave and go to work in the morning, they come back at night, and they're tired. And I'm telling you, I get tired too. I don't want to go running around. But back in the day, everybody used to sit on the porch. And they would gossip, and everybody knew what was going on. I want you to ride around and tell me how many people you see sitting on the porch talking to each other. You don't see it. Except at a place like Hepburn. I've seen it every hour of every day, and you all have a gift here that you can carry with you when you go back to your communities and instill that same sort of experience across the country. So I got done talking to Kenny, and he said, where are you staying tonight? And I said, what I always say, I said, I have no idea. What do you suggest? Because I'm cheap and I'm hopeful. And he said, I have a burnt out RV in the backyard if you want to go sleep in that. And I said, that sounds pretty good. And he said, in the morning, we'll go out looking for alligators. And I said, that sounds pretty good too. And we did that. He said, if you can stick around one more night, shrimping season starts, and I'll take you out on the Gulf of Mexico. I said, that sounds pretty good to me. So I got to see the boats, I got to ride on the boats out on the Gulf of Mexico. We went out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We came back at 8 o'clock in the morning. And in the meantime, we caught 1,200 pounds of shrimp. And I haven't eaten a shrimp since. That's not fair, I didn't eat shrimp before. So, when I started this project, I thought there's no reason that this should be me to do this. I don't have an advanced degree. I don't have any secret answers. It wasn't that long ago that my wife suggested to me that maybe I should go back and reread the book I had written about peace, which is fair, right? We all struggle. We all fall down. But just because we know we're going to struggle doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep trying. And so I thought maybe this should be me that goes around and talks to these people with all these different experiences, but then go one step more and share these experiences with everybody I meet. So, in the course of the project, drove 40,000 miles over 3.5 or 4 years, 9 separate trips, couldn't do it all at once, I had to also make a living. So I subsidized this with my assignment work, visited 46 states, interviewed over 100 people. And we took these stories and we put them together in the book. We put them together in these exhibits. And we've got 4 exhibits like this that we bring around to colleges and corporations and community centers, not to give people the secret meaning to the answer of peace, but to encourage them to be a part of the conversation, to help people recognize that we can all be a part of the solution. We can all work towards positive change in the world. So I've done hundreds of interviews like this now across the country. People have asked me along the way what I've learned, and at first that was a really hard question to answer. There's so many little bits of wisdom that people share, but eventually there are some themes that bubbled up, and I've come to call those my lessons on the road to peace, and I want to share five of those with you tonight. And the first of those is to be willing to listen to difficult realities. Be willing to be uncomfortable in conversation. So I was headed down to Alabama in August. That's not the right time to go to Alabama, in case you didn't know. And I tend to have most of these interviews lined up before I leave home. I want to make sure that I'm productive out on the road. But the day before I got to Alabama, my interview fell through. So I didn't have anyone to talk to. So I threw it out to social media, and I said, does anybody know anybody I can talk to in Alabama? And two different people said, well, you ought to go to Selma and meet a woman named Joanne Blank. And so I Googled her name, I found her phone number, I called her up and explained the project, and I said, what are the odds that you have 5 hours free tomorrow? And she said, come on over. And Joanne marched with Dr. King from Selma to Montgomery when she was 11 years old, in one of the defining moments of the Civil Rights Movement, the March for Voter Rights. I sat with Joanne in her living room in Selma 12 days after Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, Missouri. So I promise you that there were uncomfortable moments during that conversation. Not because of anything that Joanne did, she was a gracious host, but because of the dynamics of what's going on in our country. And here I was, a middle-aged white guy from up north, sitting with a civil rights icon who was frustrated and angry that we had not yet achieved in our country what she set out to do when she was 11 years old. And as we sat and talked, she said, if I was a child, we might have a fist fight this morning and we'd be playing by noon. You know, we'd still be buddy-buddy. But adults, we hold onto craziness. We hold on to stupidity. And you got a wall that you can throw up, and I got a wall that I can throw up that wasn't there when we were kids. You know, we just shared what children share, a sense of peace and freedom, to play, to love, and just be happy. And what happens as we grow up is life. And sometimes that makes us better, but oftentimes it makes us worse. She said, one day we'll be all right, but I'm tired of waiting for one day. I want it to be now. I want it to be in my lifetime. When I was growing up in the 60s, I thought by now we'd have that beloved community and everything would be peaceful, but it hasn't happened yet. We've got work to do as a country, and if we're going to get there, we're going to have to be willing to be uncomfortable with some of those conversations. Lesson two, look for solutions. I met John George in Detroit, Michigan, just on the other side of the state. And I knew that Detroit had struggled. I'd never seen it for myself. And I went there, and as John put it, he said, when the nation gets a cold, Detroit gets the flu. And right about then, Detroit was suffering from double pneumonia, as he said. And he told the story about living there. And he lived next to a crack house. And he had a young child at home, and he had another one on the way. And he did everything he could think of to change that situation. He called the police department, he called City Hall, and nobody would or could do anything about it. And so he thought about leaving. He didn't want to raise his kids that way, but then he thought, wait a minute, this is my home, and I pay my taxes, and I take out the garbage, and I mow my lawn. This is crazy. I'm not going anywhere. So instead, he went to the hardware store, and he bought plywood, nails, and paint. And he came home and he boarded up the crack house, and when the drug dealers came back, they couldn't get in and they kept on moving. So this worked out pretty good for John, and he could have stopped right there with that little spark of success, but instead he fanned it into a flame and he invited his neighbors to do the same thing. And he started getting volunteers, and now he runs an organization called Motor City Blight Busters. They have tens of thousands of volunteers. They've torn down thousands of derelict buildings, abandoned houses, and they've replaced them with community gardens and orchards, and they've taken what used to be a liability and they've turned it into an asset. And John says that we're out to change the world and we're starting in Detroit, which I think is a pretty bold statement, but I also think he might be able to do it. And he said, we all know what the problems are, and there are many. But to continue to focus on the problems and not also find a solution is a mistake. It's easy to get lost in the problem. Make sure we also take the time to look for that solution. Stay at the table. This is Maham Khan, who I met at Harper College in Palatine, Illinois. She told a story about starting there as a first-year student, and she's Muslim. Her faith was pretty private. She didn't wear hijab, so nobody really knew she was Muslim. She got to school and she decided, like everybody else, she needed to get involved, to make new friends, to broaden out her experience beyond just her academic work. So she decided to join the Muslim Student Association. She went to the first meeting and somehow she got elected as the president. So she was a little bit outside of her comfort zone. But she thought, okay, I can do this. Right, on Tuesday nights, we'll talk about Quranic verses. On Thursdays, we're going to have pizza. How hard could this be? What could go wrong? Well, this was 2001. And a few weeks later, 9/11 happened, and all of a sudden, she was way outside of her comfort zone. Right? All of a sudden, she was the head of this organization that was the center of frustration and fear and misunderstanding and anger on campus. And when we find ourselves that uncomfortable, we usually do one of two things. We either run away, or we face it head on. And that's what Maham decided to do. She started organizing interfaith dialogue sessions on campus. She realized pretty quickly that when people walk by each other in the hallway and they mumble things under their breath, this raises tension. But when they sit down face to face, and they start a dialogue, and they begin a relationship, and they get to know one another, that this reduces tension. And she said this works really well at her campus because people were willing to stay at the table. When we have a challenge, as long as we're at the table, as long as we're in dialogue and we're in relationship with one another, there's a chance that we can find a resolution for that conflict. When we walk away from the table, the hope walks away with us. And so I'll ask you tonight, when things get difficult, will you stay at the table?
Try again.
This is Hassan Ihsan Salim. Where is Hassan's story? Here he is. Hassan grew up in the Maldives, which is the island nation off the coast of India, lowest lying nation on the planet, average elevation of 4 feet above sea level. So as climate change and sea levels rising do their thing, Maldives is going to be one of the first countries to be affected. Hassan had never seen a horse in his life, but he had this inexplicable love of John Wayne movies and Louis L'Amour novels. So every year for his birthday, his dad would give him a little toy horse, and every year it would get a little bit bigger. And when he was in high school, he signed up for an exchange program, and he came over to live and study in the United States with a family in Las Vegas, New Mexico. Not the big, shiny, light Vegas, but the little dusty town of Las Vegas, New Mexico. And they had horses. And Hassan learned not only to ride horses, but he learned how to train them in the vaquero style, which is a Spanish style of training that doesn't have any strict deadlines, and so your horse might learn something one day and forget it the next, and learn it again and forget it again. And it can be really frustrating, but eventually it turns out this really great horse. I gotta believe Hassan's like the only Maldivian cowboy in the world. I don't know. But Hassan said, even with horses, people say, oh, you've been working with this horse for 6 months and he still sucks. His words, not mine. He said, and I say, well, I'm going to keep on trying. And one day that horse is going to be great. And I'll ride him in the biggest rodeo. And I'm going to take him up into the high country and pull his steer. And it's going to be the most beautiful thing in the world. And he said, and that's the goal. With horses, with peace. He said, one day there's going to be peace. And maybe I'll not live to see it. And maybe my kids won't live to see it. But we'll know that we tried. He said, and that's the goal. That we've done our part. And that's why we do it again and again. And lesson number 5, forgive. So I was bringing my exhibit out to New York University a few years ago. We drove right by the exit for Newtown, Connecticut. And this was just a month after the shooting at Sandy Hook happened. And so there were flags in the snow right at the exit for each of the victims. And it got really quiet in the van. And I knew I wanted to talk to somebody who had been touched by public violence, but I also knew I didn't want it to be Sandy Hook. I felt like this was really new. I felt like the families were being pulled out in front of the media and used as sound bites for this political debate. And I wanted something with a little bit more context and a little bit more time and perspective. So later that summer, I was going through Oklahoma City, and I was able to connect with Bud Welch. And Bud's only child, his daughter Julie Marie, graduated from Marquette University in 1995. And she was fluent in 5 languages. She got a job with the Social Security Administration in the Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City. And 4 months later, Timothy McVeigh blew it up. So Julie Marie and 186 other people died that day, and Bud fell apart. Right, of course he did. He became an alcoholic, he lost his businesses, he wanted nothing more than for Timothy McVeigh to be executed. Get him off the face of the earth and let me try to go on with my life. Until he saw a news clip of Timothy McVeigh's father on TV. And he looked at it and he said, "That guy looks as wrecked as I am." His world changed the same day my world changed. And he decided that he needed to reach out to Timothy McVeigh's father. And this took him a few years before he found the courage and found the way to do it. But eventually, he's sitting at the McVeigh family home at the kitchen table with Tim's dad. All the pictures, family pictures hanging up on the wall, including Timothy McVeigh. And these two dads who lost so much on that same day became unlikely friends. And he said that's when he realized he didn't want Tim to die. So he started working against the execution of Timothy McVeigh. And he didn't succeed. McVeigh was executed pretty quickly. But now Bud goes around the world working against capital punishment. Having figured out for him, he got no sense of relief. He got no sense of peace from the loss of one more life. And Bud says, "Before Tim's execution, I started feeling like I was forgiving him." Now that's a process and it takes time. I don't know how to teach it, but I know that I went through it. And I can tell you one thing. Forgiveness doesn't do a damn thing for the killers, but you totally free yourself. And that's where the good comes from. So for me, each of these stories is a little point of light. Each of these stories is an example of what works in the world. And if we can find a way to take those examples and move them out into the world, use them as our models for how we operate in the world, I think we can get a little bit closer to that beloved community Dr. King talked about. I think we can get a little bit closer to peace. And it was Dr. King that said, hate cannot drive out hate, only what? Love can do that. And darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. As it turns out, as I become more and more convinced every day, we are that love, and we are that light. And we've got a lot of work to do. Thank you. How about questions? Do we have time for questions? Yeah? Do we have questions? Yes. Oh, good. I like questions.
How did you connect with your subjects?
How did I connect with the subjects? Yeah, that's a great question. And there are 57 people in this book, and there are probably 57 different ways to answer that. But really, as this became more complicated, my first book, the black and white book, was all in Minnesota. This book was all from across the country, and it became more complicated the further away I went. So I tried to find advocates in every community. I would find people who I thought would understand what I was trying to do in the project, and I would ask for their help to connect with people. And I might give them demographic suggestions. I would say, you know, I've interviewed too many women. I need to have a male in this area, or I want to talk to somebody around this issue. But then I would say a good story trumps everything. You know, so this is my goal, but if you've got a surprise, go ahead and surprise me. And they would usually give me, you know, 5 or 6 different suggestions, and then I would sort of look at how my mix was falling for the project, what stories I had already heard, and then I would just say, ooh, this sounds new, this is interesting, and connect that way. So I tried to be really careful to make sure that I reached out to different sorts of advocates in different towns. If you reach out to a human rights organization in every town, they'll feed you the same sort of person. But so I would talk to a storytelling festival at one place, and I'd talk to the Humanities Council at another place, and a youth organization in another town, so that they could feed me different sorts of stories. And as the project was growing, people regularly would point out to me its failures. They would say, you know, I don't see enough young people, or I don't see any Native American voices, or I don't see anybody with a disability. And so then I would become intentional about inviting those voices in. Because sometimes we don't know what our blind spots are. We're not even aware of what we don't know. And so when people would point that out to me, rather than getting defensive and saying, don't tell me how to do my project, I would go, oh yeah, you're right. Let's find a way to invite that in. It's a long answer to your short question. Yeah, sure. What else?